section and everything is coming to an end. So in 2 weeks, Joshua will be back here. And so I thought, since this is the last time I'm going to be speaking here in this season, that I would like to tell you about one of the theme verses for this sabbatical, which you might not know about. Before Joshua left, he put together this team of people to just kind of pray about Frankfort and Norris and kind of talk about how it's going. And a few people on that team are Lauren Sichter, myself, Rob Wetherington, and Jeremy Avellino. So we've gotten together four times just to talk about the sabbatical and how things are going. And the first time that we got together, I brought four or five verses that had just stood out to me while I was preparing for a talk or reading the Bible or praying. I don't really know how to do that kind of thing, but I just said, here's a few that stand out to me. I wanted to read them to you and see if any stand out to you. And I did, and they all said that one. I feel like we should, you know, kind of focus on that verse. So it became our theme verse for the summer. So I don't know if it's like a word from God or something like that, but it did kind of make sense to all of us. And since then, it's become this lens that we kind of look at things through. So maybe it resonates for some of you as well. It's a fairly abstract verse, and the Bible is just open to so many possible meanings anyways that it might relate with you or it might not, but it's worth sharing in case, you know, there is something in it for us as a congregation. And that verse is from Isaiah 40. It is, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness. Make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. The reason why I was initially drawn to it, why I brought it in the first place, is that I just think of highways being bad things, because I think of the 76 and all the traffic and it going through like beautiful areas, you know, and you think like, oh man, too bad there's this highway. I forget about how it like connects us to so many things and how great it is. But also, it just doesn't sound like Bible language to me, because I grew up with that sense that like the Jesus way is the narrow way, more like you're like the woman on wire, and you might fall into the burning flames, but Jesus is your bridge, and that makes a cross. I don't know if you drew that picture, but I thought, like, Bible language is about small, tiny little things that you have to be really careful about, not like, clear the way for this really big, easy, quick, happy, fun, broad highway for God. So when I read that, I was like, oh, that sounds way more fun. That's why it stood out to me. And also just the clearing and the making smooth just seemed like something we were going through. Some of you are more new, and some of you have been around way longer than I have, but this summer it just has felt like some clearing and some cleaning and some smoothing, and I wonder what it's for, and I feel excited about that. This verse might sound familiar to you because it is used in all four of the Gospels from John the Baptist, kind of as a way to say Jesus is coming. So even though this verse is in Isaiah, which I'll talk about, and it means something specific to the Jewish people at that time, it's used for Jesus, and it could be used for us too. It could mean a lot of things. A little bit about Isaiah is that it's a book of prophecy, and it's a meditation on the city of Jerusalem. And that city is not only a real city, it's like a real urban center with like political stuff going on and militaries that want to overthrow it, but it's also this like really symbolic thing to the Jewish people, more than just the city. It's the place that God has promised that God will be present in, and it's like the seat of the Davidic thing, throne, that the Bible talks a lot about. So it has all this meaning to it. So Isaiah is like this prophecy poem about Jerusalem, but it means a lot of different things. It was thought to be written by three different people. So I just made up this little slide to make it easier. Basically, like the first section was written at one time, and then chapters 40 to 55 were written later, and then the third Isaiah was written later. And that first... In that first chunk in the 8th century, Yahweh makes promises to protect and sustain Jerusalem. And then in 701 BC, they really do have a miraculous thing happen, which is that Assyria comes to take over Jerusalem and they don't win. And everyone's like shocked that that happened. So they're like, oh my gosh, it's true. Like God is going to protect us. And then the Babylonians come in and take over Jerusalem and they all have to be deported to Babylon. So those chapters are marked by loss because what they thought that God was going to protect them and then God didn't. And they have to leave their home and their culture and the like the center of their faith and everything and be exiles in this city, Babylon. So the second section, they're exiles, and it's written about 200 years later, and it's right before the Persians. Obviously, I didn't know any of this. Right before the Persians are going to overthrow the Babylonians, and that happens, and so this prophet Isaiah says, it's going to be okay. You guys are going to go home. It's going to be wonderful. And so these chapters are characterized by hope because the people are like, really? Do we really get to go home? And then the third part of Isaiah is a prophet writing about the struggles of having come home to Jerusalem. But it's 200 years later and things are different and they don't have their culture as much anymore and they're figuring out how, like, what does this mean in light of everything we've gone through with God? So it's like a real up and down book with a lot of emotions. And the actual book the actual chapter 40, which is where the verse I read is in, is called the Book of Consolation because it's kind of the beginning of this hope section. And I don't know if any of you have read Walter Rangren's Book of the Duncan, the Book of Sorrows. Anyone? No. Should I just not tell you what I was going to say? The Book of Sorrows, I'm wondering if Walter wrote it as a prequel to this Book of Consolation. It's kind of like from an animal's eye view, what the kind of loss that the people are experiencing here. So that doesn't mean anything to any of you. Anyways, Isaiah 40 is just like a completely beautiful chapter. I feel like it's the Bible in microcosm. Like it tells this romance story, and it basically says there's nobody like God, and it has all these really clever ways of saying that, and it says God is always watching despite what you think or feel. God is always engaged in everything that is going on in the world, even though so much of that is hidden, and God is the only thing that can make everything new despite all of the pain and suffering in the world. And even the first two lines of Isaiah 40 are comfort, comfort. And I always thought that was Isaiah telling the people, take comfort, take comfort. And it says that in Hebrew, that word is a plural imperative. So it's like a command given to multiple people. And I read that God is telling the angels in his holy council, which I was like, what? to comfort the people. So it makes me wonder, like, is that still going on? Like, in the spiritual realms, are angels and holy council people charged to comfort us as we wait for the thing the entire world's been waiting for, which is this kind of restoration that Isaiah 40 talks about? More on this specific verse now. I'm just going to talk about what I think it means to the Jewish people at the time, and I don't know very much about that, and then just a few examples of what it might mean for us. There's this literary tool I learned about in the Psalms, and it looks like it's happening here too in the Bible, where have you noticed where things seem redundant? Like you read something and then the next line says the same thing again in the Proverbs and Psalms especially. I think it's the same thing here in that, you know, the first line is repeated in the second line just with some different words. And what I learned about with the Psalms is that the second line is kind of more extreme or more poignant version of the first. And when this happens, it's kind of like something that's important. So like our slow minds get like another chance to hear it again. So I just put it like that to kind of show that to me, we're talking about the same thing, wilderness, desert, clear and making smooth. It's just like more ways to say the same thing. The way for the Lord and a highway for our God are just ways to say the same thing. So first I'll start with the highway, what I think the highway meant to the Jewish people. I think it sounds like it actually meant the road that they were going to use to travel from Babylon back to their home on, like in a very literal way. They're exiles, and now they're free. They don't have to be slaves anymore. They can walk back to their home. And the first time this highway is used is five chapters earlier in this prophecy, where Isaiah says, "A highway shall be there, and it shall be called the Way of Holiness." And it basically says it's going to be a safe place. No beasts will be on it. No enemies will be on it, which these people are really scared. And that probably is very relevant to them to hear, no, literally, you can go back home, and I will protect you on it. It will be a safe place for you to go. And there's a few words in there like ransomed and redeemed and unclean that when I read that, I automatically hear like Christianese for, which is that those words mean like your spiritual status, like are you going to heaven or not? And as I was reading about Isaiah, I kept hearing that those words are where we misinterpret them a lot if we think that's what they mean. Like unclean means like a bad person. These words are like cultural and ritual words. So ransomed is like a family law term, meaning to buy someone back from slavery or the animal that was going to be used in a sacrifice. So it doesn't necessarily mean like the bad people aren't going to walk on it and only the good people are. It means literally like enslaved people are not going to be enslaved anymore. They're going to be freed and they're going to walk on this road. And another little layer to the highway that's cool is that I guess Babylon had this like fancy highway that kings and their gods and stuff would walk on to like march in the city and parade around. And so the ironic twist to that is now the oppressor's highway is going to be used to usher people back home, which reminds me of the Exodus when the enslaved people got to go free in this Red Sea that used to keep them trapped. You know, God was like, I'll use that now to be your secret passageway out of this. I'll open up the Red Sea and let you get out. So that's what I see in the highway part for them. In the about the wilderness for them and clearing the way and everything, I mean, from what I understand, it seems like there was literally wilderness between Babylon and Jerusalem. And Debbie knows a lot about this and saying yes. So it could be just part of Isaiah is just telling the story of these people, and he's a great storyteller. What we get to do as well is now hear it for our day, which somehow the Bible does that. I don't know how it does that, how it can speak about what's actually going on and like really speak to their hearts and then do that for us as well. But I understand the wilderness to really be a hard journey, and so for God to say, I will help you get back there safely, I will make a smooth way in the desert and in the wilderness for you to do that, seems like that's what God did. So what I think it could mean for us, I have a few ideas of examples, but mainly this summer I've just been using that verse in my mind a lot to think of it. And again, yeah, I don't know if that's always the best thing to do, but it's more fun at least to like kind of have some direction that you use as a guide. I keep feeling like, yeah, we're supposed to clear the way through the wilderness and we're supposed to make way this like highway for God, this place that is easy for people to get to God and to keep that as your focus and like not get too confused or thrown off by other things. And something I love about that idea is just the walking that's implied in a highway. Because it's easy for me to just think that I have my normal life, my day-to-day stuff, where you're like, you just can't wait to have a day off work so that you can do what you want. And sometimes I just think maybe every day all the time really just is my life. Maybe how I separate what's spiritual and what's profane, or what's like free time and what's work time, maybe those divisions aren't really true. Maybe it's more about my perspective. So something about this idea of just walking, being my calling, sounds really nice to me. And it is like a very common spiritual formation word, the idea of walking. And there's tons of verses in the Bible about it. Just like, you know, walk, or this is love, I think 1 John says, walk in my commands. And the Shema in the Old Testament is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. Walk, or talk about these things when you walk along the road, when you lie down, and when you get up. Like, when you do your normal life, talk about these things, loving the Lord your God. And Jesus is like a huge walker too. I remember when I like kind of read the Gospels for like what they, just for the day-to-day stuff that was in them, I thought all he does is walk around. He just walks from cities into deserts, into nature, into someone's home, and the entire time he's teaching, and all of his examples are just the things he sees that a normal person would see while walking. He's like, oh, look at that fig tree. Oh, look at the storm clouds. You know, this woman sweeping out her house. I have a story about that. Something about that freedom, that my boring, normal life is where God is found, just sounds great for the fall, to think of it like that. The clearing part, you know, clearing the way for God, I ultimately think God is the one who does that. But I also see ways that I could do that, that I could clear my way to God. And one way I've been thinking about it is thinking of the reality that God is what I really want. So it's kind of a helpful image for me to think of a highway, and, you know, it's the highway is God, and it leads to God. And Chesterton has this quote, I don't know what book it's in, but I just remembered it. It's every man who knocks on the door of a brothel is looking for God. And I feel like that about my life. I do not knock on brothel doors, but everything I do is kind of me looking for God. Every time I open the fridge or go shopping or have a fight with my husband about something, I am looking for God. And so something about that image of a highway for our God helps me think, like, what I really want is God. On my best days, I know that, and all the days in between, I don't remember that. But it's helpful for me to sometimes I just think highway to God, because I think, like, I could go that route and, like, get all weird, or I know what I really want. It's to be loved, and it's to like have a purpose in my life. I know what I want is God, and so I'm just gonna stick to that. And I feel like that's a great like personal mission statement, but as a congregation, that's like so beautiful to be a place that reminds each other and reminds ourselves and kind of communicates, maybe without words, like we know what everyone really wants is God. And we will try to make a safe place to explore that and to admit that. And we'll try to like bring down the mountains, the obstacles to God that so many people have, which are usually ideas about how God's hard to access, or like you have to get God or earn God. We could be like, no, you don't at all. So we'll bring that down. That's just not true. And then there's like some pitfalls that we could, as a congregation, just try to like, we don't have to go there. We'll just help you connect to God. The few examples I thought of for how this might relate to us is to admit that there's a wilderness. That's not my strong suit. I'm very optimistic about things. And so sometimes I think I can take for granted that some things are better than others. Maybe it's my like postmodernism background where I just think, don't call anything bad or good, you know. Everything has a purpose. And the older I get, the more I just think, no, there is a wilderness. There are things that can trap me for a long time. And I feel like it's okay to have a sense of urgency about that, which so many people in the Bible did. Jesus had an urgency, and then all of the disciples, when they like preach after and stuff, they're always like, repent, like today is the day. And I thought, well, maybe they really thought Jesus was coming back the next day, but I don't think they did necessarily. I just think they're like, who knows what's going to happen? Rod said that yesterday at a meeting. He was like, I mean, who knows what's going to happen with the world? And I thought, like, Rod, I mean, I've been alive for 31 years and it's totally fine. What are you talking about? Are you just paranoid or you read a lot of sci-fi? And then I was like, no, who knows what's going to happen? Like, for a lot of people, maybe some of you, the worst thing you could ever imagined might have happened. And for a lot of people in the world, that has happened. And we really don't know. So that whole, like, life is short thing, I feel that urgency now to, like, to have more urgency about my faith and my relationship with all of you and what we're going to do. And one thing I thought of was today's Circle of Hope daily prayer had the Lord's Prayer in it. And I admitted to myself that I've never really liked the part about lead me not into temptation or deliver me from evil, just because it's like negative. I like the part about the bread and forgiveness and heaven on earth, but those parts I just didn't really relate with. And now I do relate with them. I feel like, yeah, if the disciples ask Jesus, what should we pray? It makes sense to me why that's in there. You know, please do not lead me into temptation. I know that what I want is God, and I know from experience that I can, after weeks and months of being in a certain place, be like, what am I doing? Like, this is not taking me to where I want to go, not where my parents think I should go or where my pastor thinks I should go, but this is not where I want to go. So I now I like that part of the Lord's Prayer. I feel like any regular day is suitable to say, you know, deliver me from evil. And the next thing I thought of, the making smooth part, the new word I like is being proactive, which just did not sound as cool when I said it out loud. Because it's like such a common word, I guess. But I feel like it's okay to admit that there are things that cause pain in our lives and there are roadblocks for us to where we want to go. Like if gluten makes your stomach hurt, it's okay not to eat it. And it's okay not to do other things that you've learned have hurt you. And it doesn't mean you're going to become like your mom or your dad or your youth group leader or like the Christian radio host if you say, I want to have some boundaries in my life to help me get to where I want to go. And thinking of boundaries, my dad like told me to read that book, Boundaries. Do you guys know that book? And I've never read it because he told me to. And now I'm saying, I have boundaries. But I have boundaries. I admit it. My name's Vanessa. So a few things that I know are roadblocks for me are doing well, being busy, and just like being stuck. Doing well makes a lot of sense to me. I've talked about the false self a lot this summer, but if my false self is doing great, like everyone likes me, and if I'm in a winning streak where I'm successful at everything and I'm funny and I don't know, I don't break out and stuff like that, I don't need God. And I just like go along. The picture I have is standing in this highway, you know, that's to God, and I'm just like looking in the mirror or something. That would be like a good image. Or narcissist looking in the pond, just being like, oh, aren't you beautiful? You're so beautiful. And then something happens that you can't control, where you're humiliated or you do fail and you're embarrassed or something happens in your life and you kind of wake up from that and you think like that, like, I hate this feeling, but I'm so glad for the like wake-up call, because our true state isn't supposed to be dependent on how we look, feel, act, how people think about us. Our true state is being dependent on God, and that really is our freedom. So one way I've tried to change my mind about this summer is when little things like that happen, the things that embarrass me, or when I don't make sense when I talk, or feeling insecure or something like that, instead of my instinct being to reject those moments, I think, like, sure, bring that on. That's great. It says in Paul, not in Paul, Paul says it in somewhere, that my grace is sufficient for you, my power is perfected in weakness. So if we just changed our minds and we thought weaknesses are cool now, then maybe all those little things in the day could actually be for our strengthening and our uplifting rather than like signs that we're not doing well or we're embarrassed or something like that. Another roadblock for me is being busy. And the picture I have of that is just being on the highway instead of like walking on it. I'm just like chasing my own tail or something like that. And it's a great distraction from life and from God for me. And I will do it. I've had so many like New Year's resolutions that address busyness, and I know that I will keep filling up my time. And part of it is to distract myself from being alone and having to think about that. So I feel like now I know to take opportunities when they come up that are kind of counter busy, like the women's retreat coming up. It's the first year I really am excited for it. And part of it is because I know that just going away and not being left to my own agenda is so good for me. Doesn't even matter what gets said there or what happens there. I know in the spiritual realms for me to do that is great. And Stephen and I, my husband and I, were talking about, like, who do we want to be? And, like, when are we ever going to get to those things on our list about our relationship that we want to talk about, but you need time to, like a beach day, you know? And he was like, let's do a retreat ourselves, like 3 days to just pray and talk about who we want to be. And it can feel indulgent or something. And then you think, in the light of your year or your life, what is 3 days? What is taking out 3 days to do that? So that's another way that I feel like I combat being busy is by taking opportunities. I probably won't make them, so I try to take them. And the last part I feel like could relate to us about the highway verse is just saying that we are on the highway to God and believing that and having the dignity to be worthy of that path instead of spending time wondering how to get on it or whether we're on it or whether we're off it. Are we on a side road? But just to try and experiment for a while where we just say, like, no, I know that is what I want. I don't totally know everything that's going on in my life or whether I'm making the right decisions in all these areas, but I am on the highway. I will try, like, claiming my dignity as a child of God like that. That's who I am, and that's where I want to go, even if I don't act like it a lot of times. And I do think that for Frankfurt and Norris, I don't know, this is just my idea, that one thing we could have more of is more dignity and more desire. I don't think we're short on that. Stephen hung out with Luke White the other week, and I don't know what they were talking about, but it was some like controversial thing, and he came home and said, guess what Luke said? He said, I think the church should just have more self-esteem. And I was like, I mean, doesn't that sound like Luke? if you need self-esteem, you can go to him and he'll tell you that you have it. Or like, never mind. So the church, I was like, yes, that's, the church does need to have self-esteem. And we need to be able to claim that dignity. There's a story that Howard Thurman tells that I'll close with. I talked about him last week. He's an author of this book, Jesus and the Disinherited, and he was important to Martin Luther King. But he had a friend who was a young German woman, and she told him surprising news one day, which was that she said, you know, Hitler was a very magnetic personality, especially to German youth. She said German youth had lost their sense of belonging. They didn't think they counted. They didn't matter. There was no center of hope for them. And she said that Hitler told them, you know, no one loves you, but I love you. No one will give you work, but I will give you work. No one wants you, but I want you. And then the book says, when they saw the sunlight in his eyes, they dropped their tools and followed him. And I so familiar. Jesus says stuff like that. I mean, one of his most common phrases is, you have heard this, but I tell you this. Or, they say this, but I tell you that. That's like Jesus's move that Hitler pulled. And it might as well be a verse in the Gospels, the way that at least Thurman wrote it. You know, when they saw the sunlight in Jesus's eyes, they dropped their nets and followed him. And that just got me thinking, like, wow, we are so susceptible. Like, Hitler stabilized the ego of German youth, and Jesus stabilized the ego of fishermen and millions of disciples to come. And I want to make sure I'm not susceptible to other things stabilizing my ego. And that's how I think about the highway for God, clearing the way through the wilderness and the desert is admitting something will. I will find something to stabilize my ego. We have to have a self. Like, we have to have a sense of that. We will get it somewhere. So we have to be intentional and proactive about where we're going to get it, and we have to keep doing it. We have to keep being intentional, proactive about where we're doing it, because one of the biggest myths in my life is that, like, religion will take care of that for you or something. Or, you know, if you lead a cell or if you're part of a church, that you don't have to really try as hard or work as hard anymore, when that becomes a whole nother, like, shadow that we can get a lot of ammunition or security from in a false way from. So that's all I have. There's a few minutes if you have any questions, or if that verse sounded like something else to you, or any stories that this reminded you of, feel free to share. Jody? Yeah, Jody, that's a great example. I don't know how to do that very well yet. I know that I've probably been the wilderness for some people. And I hope that when I learn how to do that well, like how to kind of maintain what I know I need and still love someone, that I can do it in a way that sounds loving to them. Because I've tried it with family members especially, and I just come off sounding like, can't say the word, and I can't think of another word, so you guys know what I think. I just come off sounding like that, and so I don't know how to do that yet. That's a great point. Joseph? Great. Let's be happy. Mike's going to come back up.
Hey, everyone. I'm going to take a couple of minutes to let you know about some cool events going on in and outside of our community. While I do that, there's these black binders on the end of your rows. If you